We've got members that have to get to the committee.
Right. The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. Before we start, 1 o'clock committees face a particular challenge, and that they're immediately after lunch. And the clock in the House lounge is a little on the slow side. But next week is a new week. Let's all work together to make an effort to come to committee and start at 1 o'clock. That'd be great. All right.
Madam Chair.
Whatever, Madam Chair. So if you have a cell phone with you, please turn it off. Not to vibrate, but all the way off. And we're going to open a series of public hearings all together. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2605, 2606, 2607, and 2719. Kevin.
Do all these at once. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to just kind of run through the order real briefly. We'll start with House Bill 2605, establishes the critical need foreign language study abroad scholarship program within the Department of Education, requires that the Department of Education award scholarships to students grades 9 through 12 who participate for 1 year in a study abroad program that enables students to learn critically needed foreign languages. There's a standard which will guide this program by reviewing with the U.S. Department of Education and U.S. Department of State, which languages are priorities. It also has an appropriation from the general fund to the Department of Education. That would be 2605. House Bill 2607 amends ORS 329.451 to allow a school district or public charter to award a diploma to a student who fails to satisfy one or more of the graduation requirements when the student completes a study year in a study abroad program, and the student would make progress towards the satisfying graduation requirements so that they would have been graduating but for the student abroad program. House Bill 2607, foreign language issue is the theme today. 2607 provides an appropriation of $1.6 million from the General Fund of the Department of Education for purposes of developing five Mandarin immersion programs throughout the state with, if practicable, having those programs being in each of the congressional districts. And House Bill 2719, rounded out, modify some definitions of what is a residential pupil for purposes of the state school fund statutes. Also require school district to award a grant to students who participate in an approved study abroad program and creates funds. I think most of these have emergency clauses that exist.
Great. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
For those that don't have the benefit of the copy, the second one that Kevin mentioned was 2606, not 2607, so just so they can follow along.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bailey. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing beautiful House District 42, Inner Southeast Portland. And I appreciate you hearing these bills today. Before we get started, I really want to acknowledge the leadership of Dave Porter, who's been really instrumental in helping us come to this point on these bills. And I want to acknowledge the leadership of Representative Richardson, who sends his regards. He wishes he could be here today and has been quite an ally and a partner in crime on these bills. These bills really represent a framework for moving forward to allow Oregon's children to compete in the 21st century. It acknowledges the role that international trade and linkages are going to play in Oregon's economy, the role that our neighbor across the other pond in China will play in an emerging global economy, and also as well that critical languages are important around the world, not just Mandarin, but other critical languages that we need for our children to be studying in order to be competitive going forward. I want to tell you a little bit about my personal experience learning languages. I've had the benefit of having studied languages since I was a child, I was able to participate in Lincoln High School's Magnet Program in Portland, Oregon, the International Studies Center program, in which languages were a required part of that program. And throughout high school, I actually studied Russian. And it wasn't until I was in college that I had the opportunity to begin studying Mandarin. And I can tell you what a difference that made to me to be able to be exposed to the process of learning another language and how much easier it is once you've started studying a foreign language, even if that's not the language you go on to master, to then learn other languages and to be able to pick those up when you're abroad. It really is a way of molding and shaping your mind to thinking about things in terms of other languages. I mentioned I studied Russian through high school. I had an opportunity during high school as well to do a study abroad program in Khabarovsk, Russia, and I spent some time there studying, living with a Russian family. And not only was that experience important for me in terms of learning the language, it was also an incredible opportunity as a high school student to be able to go live in a place that it was just after the fall of the Soviet Union, to be able to experience those events firsthand, to learn from the people, to see how it affected them. The cultural awareness that brought about was something that I couldn't have achieved in any other way. And quite frankly, it was addictive. When I was in college, I ended up taking a semester off and went and worked in Vietnam and had a chance to see how the people there are living and building their economy. And then shortly after I graduated from college, I had an opportunity to move to China and teach English in China and learn Chinese and meet my future wife. So there's other benefits as well. My current wife, who is then my future wife. So,
as a wife, I can say current wife is usually a phrase you wish to avoid.
Yes, ma'am. My dear, lovely, one and only true wife.
There you go.
So I appreciate the members recognizing and hearing these bills today. I want to make the point that I understand that we are in tough times here in Oregon, and that an investment, especially in programs that are new programs or innovative programs, is sometimes not an easy thing to do. In my view, this is really an investment in making sure that Oregon's economy is strong and stable for the long term. And this is about making sure that when Oregon begins to emerge from this recession, as we do so, we have the tools and the skills in our population to be at the forefront of the manufacturing economy, of the traded sector, of the basic sectors that bring the dollars here. And that we can't do that unless our children can speak those languages and be able to relate to the people around the world that are going to be buying and selling Oregon products. So I appreciate your time hearing this, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for Representative Bailey? Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, thank you for coming and bringing these bills before us. They're all very important. The program that you mentioned in Khabarovsk really sounds fascinating to me, and I'd like to hear more about it at some point, at least.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, happy to follow up with you in detail. The quick overview was this was a program that was actually sponsored by the federal government. It was an exchange program that was set up by President Reagan, and I now cannot recall the exact name of the program, but it was something to do with a peace fellowship or something like that, that was set up, and it was public grants from the federal government to high schools to be able to facilitate better relations between our two countries. And every year, we would send a group of Russian language students to Khabarovsk, Russia, which is Portland's sister city, and they would then send a group here to Oregon. And it was a very successful program. Students still had to pay into it, but the cost of that kind of program can be prohibitive to many families. And we want to make sure that the benefits of that kind of education are available to all Oregonians and not just the ones that can afford to go overseas. I actually had an opportunity to go to China before I'd gone to Russia, and this is before I started studying Chinese, and actually very early on had an opportunity to go to Africa through a program. And we just, you know, my parents said, "Oh, we'd love to do it." Sounds like a great opportunity, but we just didn't have the money to be able to do it. And it wasn't until this opportunity happened where we had a program that was a partnership between the resources of the parent and the school as well as the federal government's resources that we were able to pay for that and engage with that. So I do think that there's a real role here for the public to be able to not only provide those resources, but also make sure that our education system is structured in such a way that students aren't penalized for taking some of that time to go over there and that it recognizes the value of that experience. Probably a longer answer than we're looking for.
No, I appreciate that, Madam Chair. And full disclosure to the committee, my daughter and Representative Bailey were classmates. However, she was on this trip a year ahead of him, I should point out. I'm not sure if it's that because she was...
much more proficient.
I don't know. Well, I think we can just leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of points. I totally concur with what you've said about the value of life abroad, understanding other cultures, etc., and about the ability to master additional languages after you've learned a second. I lived in Mexico as a kid for 3 years, which is why I periodically get to throw some Spanish out here, just because I love to speak it. When I get an opportunity, I usually throw myself in, for better and worse. One of the important things that you said in my mind that was really kind of could have just flown by is that this is about the kids from this state, because the United States has been isolated to a large degree for a long time. Oregon, I really think, has been isolated within the United States for a long time. These businesses will grow, they will succeed, they will span the globe, and the question is not whether or not that will happen, but whether or not we participate, whether or not our kids participate. Because if we only speak English, as so many of us do in this country, we're at a sore disadvantage. And it's a question of whether or not our kids get to play.
Madam Chair, may I comment?
Of course.
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, I think that your last line is a great tagline for this effort. And I would also point out, anecdotally, not to tell you all my life stories, but my cousin actually is from Coos Bay, Oregon, grew up in Charleston actually, and is currently in Azerbaijan in the Peace Corps, and has been sending back these messages that have been these columns that have been printed in the Coos Bay World. And so not only is it a benefit to the children of Oregon, but there's also a real linkage there. Folks have been able to read about it in the local paper and see what a local kid is doing over in another place, and I think it just builds a real sense of global community.
Mm-hmm. One other brief thing, I think. I'm really impressed that you actually mastered another language at post-secondary school. That's really tough. I only know one other person who's done that. It was his second language, which is really odd. For you, it was language number three or more, which I can understand. But the notion of pushing a second language at that point in life is something I think we need to think about. When we heard the other bill the other day about scholarships for kids mastering second languages, I think we should be a little... I believe you're on that bill as well as a co-sponsor.
I am.
I think we can't stress enough the importance of getting these kids into the programs early, like that young girl who was here speaking to us. I think maybe her name was Claire. But just a comment.
All right. Are there any further comments or questions before we let Representative Bailey go to transportation?
Please, I hope there are more questions.
Yes.
Thank you very much for bringing these bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Right, our next panel would be Dave Porter. Is Colin Crocker here? All right. And Troy Henry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Troy Henry.
Are you ready?
I am ready, and if you'll start by offering your name for the record, that would be helpful.
All right. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I am Dave Porter. I'm a retired health administrator. I live in Southeast Portland, and I speak only for myself. I don't represent any committee or group or anything. And thank you very much for holding this hearing. Before I get into I'm going to touch on some items that I'm passing out to you. I'm just going to indicate those. One is a New York Times article from this week, which the first sentence is about China. Well, it's all about China, but the first sentence is about China's the economy. The global economic downturn and efforts to reverse it will probably make China an even stronger economic competitor than it was before the crisis. That's one piece in there. Another piece is there were two, I tried to get one or more of Oregon's leading academic experts on Asian affairs to come today. Two were willing and interested in coming, but today's date did not fit their schedule. Here's their joint statement from them on the importance of what we're doing today and how they see China. Troy, you can sit up here with me. Troy, the other one with me here is from AFS, which is a provider of study abroad services. In your packet is a letter from another study abroad organization, the Council on International Educational Exchanges. They would have had somebody here today from out of state, but she needed to have surgery, and this date didn't work for her. I will note in that letter, one sentence in particular, over the past 3 to 4 years, only about 10% of the Oregon students we have met who have actively expressed interest in high school study abroad have been able to do so. She speculates that that's for financial reasons in most of the cases, not all. And that brings me to the next couple of pieces. I have had great difficulty getting, I had 6 bills that I wanted to bring to you to this session. 2 of those bills, and I took them to Representative Bailey in July and August, and I think July and August and September somewhere in there, working with then-Representative Rosenbaum's office. He put them into legislative council. Somewhere along the way, 2 of those bills just got lost, and I don't know the insider of how that process works, but part of it, I didn't realize it till early February, because nothing came out of legislative council of those 6 until late January. And then only some of them, and it wasn't until like the first week in February that I discovered that they just didn't have 2 of the bills. So here, and there's one critical bill there, which if you were going to do only one thing, and it costs the least, it would be the bill from last session, 2763, which is $350,000 to develop curriculum that would fit all the different situations in Oregon, not just the immersion model, and frankly to promote it around the state, to work with the school districts and see, in some sense, to see what's appropriate for them and try to get them to do more. It's my Representative Richardson, I think, introduced this last session. I think he took it from Minnesota, where they did a process like that, and they came out with a study and a report. I don't think they've moved much beyond that, but they did do it, and it did highlight what they could have done and what would be the next steps in Minnesota, and dealt with some of the issues that I haven't tried to deal with, which are, where do you get the teachers for this if you were going to expand mandate? There are certainly both how you credential them and how you get them trained issues. So I would like, I don't know what the process here in the legislature to resurrect something in that state, but I put those before you. And then the other part has been trying to get the study abroad bill, the House Bill 2719, in a fashion that was consistent with the concepts that I had back in the summer. And it's where the first draft was totally wrong. It was from the inception to be a bill that was not mandated on the local school districts, but something that they could choose as an option. And it came out one that was sort of required of them, and it didn't have many of the other provisions that I wanted in it. I've since yesterday got a second draft of it, and it still has it all garbled, and I think would create more confusion. So if there is, if there is interest in the committee going on, we need to work to get a bill. I would work off the one I have here, which I think has a lot of critical concepts in it. You can either go with them or not. That's certainly your discretion, but it's much clearer to work from it than I think anything else. Okay, now to my testimony. Sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry. I urge you to create a high school study abroad program and to spend $3 million to expand Mandarin and critical need foreign language programs for Oregon's K-12 public school students. The world's economic and geopolitical arrangements are undergoing rapid and sustained change. Consider that improved transportation and communication, together with a resulting global flow of financial investment funds, are bringing distant economies into competition with each other, making the globe seem smaller and more interconnected. And consider that the global banking firm of Goldman Sachs estimated that by 2050, the combined emerging economies of the BRIC countries, and they're listed there, could exceed the combined economies of the current richest countries in the world. And consider that during the next 30 years, 2 to 3 billion people out of a global population of 6.4 billion and growing may join the global middle class, bringing substantial new buying power into the global market. And consider that in the next few decades, roughly 80% of the world's economic growth will be found in emerging markets. And consider that the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace estimated that the economy of China will equal the size of the U.S. economy in 2035 and be twice as large in 2050. This is the global economy that today's students, our next generations, will have to compete in. To be successful, they will need the skills and knowledge to innovate, design, produce, buy, and sell in these emerging markets around the globe. I know you understand these competitive pressures and that you're working to improve our educational system and to raise the skills of our next generations with specific concerns for improving science and technology education and for raising educational achievement levels of underperforming populations. But for our next generations to survive and thrive in this future global economy, more of them will need foreign language skills and at proficiency levels higher than we now usually produce. I urge you to invigorate the study of foreign languages in Oregon public schools. The Center for Applied Second Language Studies at the University of Oregon, and Colin was to be here today, but I think he was before you on Wednesday, representative of that, has developed a useful guide for needed reform in its Oregon's Roadmap to Language Excellence. The legislation before you today can be seen as a start, but only several first steps on their roadmap. This invigoration of the study of foreign language in Oregon public schools needs your legislative leadership. Do not think that Oregon's educational establishment will on its own make these changes. Do not wait for them to ask you. Educators need to hear from you that you consider foreign language programs a priority, that Oregon's economic future is on the line, and as I will get to, that the very lives of our next generations may be at stake. Our economy will thrive to the extent that we can create new services and products and sell them in the growing global markets. For a student, nothing sparks the generation of new ideas like living in another culture and seeing the world and all its arrangements from a fresh perspective. We need to strengthen this capacity for innovation and the sense of adventure in our young. We need to send many more of our high school and college students to study abroad. Recognize there are existing study abroad programs run by a variety of reputable, well-established organizations that cost in some cases less than the average annual per student costs in our local school districts. So we could send many more students to study abroad all over the world at no additional cost to the state or to local school districts. In fact, most districts could save money by sending more students abroad. We just need to create the legal and administrative structure to do this. This is what House Bill 2719 begins to do. While we need generally to invigorate the study of foreign languages and send high school students to study all over the globe, China and its official language of Mandarin deserve top priority in our efforts. China is the biggest emerging market, and for that economic reason alone deserves special priority. But China is much, much more. As the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the Institute for International Economics put it, no relationship matters more, for better or for worse, in resolving the enduring challenges of our time, maintaining stability among great powers, sustaining global economic growth, stemming dangerous weapons proliferation, countering terrorism, and confronting new transnational threats of infectious disease, environmental degradation, international crime, and failing states. But even that sweeping statement does not capture China's critical importance. China may become, by the end of the 21st century, the globe's dominant superpower. It could become more powerful than the U.S. Our next generations may need to find a way to live peacefully with that reality or to take them on militarily. Currently, China spends about $70 billion on its military, compared to $713 billion for the U.S., or just 10% of what the U.S. spends. And China has roughly 24 nuclear-armed missiles. As deterrent, their missiles are probably targeted at U.S. cities, Probably one of those missiles is usually targeted at Portland. This is not new and should not raise any sudden alarms. Nuclear deterrence around the globe has proven to be quite stable. But consider further. As China's economy grows this century to be more than twice the size of the U.S. economy, as its investments in education and research produce a very competitive high-tech economy, they will have the capacity to considerably upgrade their military. What then? What worries me long-term, and what accounts for my passion on this Mandarin issue now, is the potential to direct trajectory of China's rising military power over this century and how the U.S. may respond. University of California, Berkeley professor Brad DeLong wrote, "Think of it this way. Consider a world power that contains one country that is a true superpower. It is preeminent economically, technologically, politically, culturally, and militarily. But it lies at the edge of a vast ocean. And across this ocean is another country. A country with more resources in the long run, a country that looks likely to, in the end, supplant the current superpower. What should the superpower's long-run national security strategy be?" "I think the answer is clear," he says. "If possible, the current superpower should embrace its possible successor. It should bind it as closely as possible with ties of blood, commerce, and culture, so that should the emerging superpower come to its full strength, it will be to as great an extent possible, share the worldview of and regard itself as part of the same civilization as its predecessors, Romans to the Greeks, and as I'll say here, the U.S. to the British. Consider our own historical experience. The U.S. rose to global superpower as the British Empire declined. The British mentored our rise to global power and thus extended their influence on the global system. We did come to their aid in two world wars, but in this case, both countries shared a common language, English, and much of the U.S. political and economic culture came from the British. Not so between the U.S. and China. We have very different languages and cultures. Yet this is the big challenge for our next generations. They simply are not now prepared. Today, many Chinese students study English. Somewhere around 1% of Oregon's public school students are studying Mandarin. Some Chinese students come to Oregon or to the U.S. more generally to study, but very few Oregon students study abroad in China. This situation is not in our long-term national interest if we wish to mentor China's rise to power, avoid war, and to solve a whole range of global problems. In four funding bills, I am proposing that Oregon spend $3 million during the 2009 through 11 biennium to begin to develop and expand Mandarin programs. Given the strategic priority I give to this effort, I would recommend spending even more. But I recognize that we are in tough economic times that put severe limits on what is possible. $3 million would be only 0.05% of a $6 billion educational budget. That does not seem to be too much for this priority. Consider what a war with China would cost. Let us, as a strategic funding priority, maximize the opportunities for peace between our two countries. Big issues are in play. Do recall that President Lincoln had hard, turbulent times during the American Civil War. Recall that President Lincoln and his Republican 37th Congress, while engaged in the Civil War, passed five visionary bills: the Homestead Act, the development of the Transcontinental Railroad, the creation of a system of land-grant colleges, the creation of the first single paper currency for the U.S., and the implementation of the first income tax. So I urge you in these hard times to take inspiration from Lincoln. Look to the future. Thank you, and I'll take any questions when it's broken.
Thank you. And I think we'll go ahead and hear from both of you first and then direct questions at both of you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Actually, despite all of my public speaking experience, somehow I forgot that my mouth gets dry when I get a little nervous. With the committee's permission, can I grab my water bottle?
You can, if you introduce yourself when you come back, for the record.
Thank you for hearing my whole testimony.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for bringing
it. I know it was a little long.
So, thank you. Thank you, Chair Gelser and committee for having me. My name is Troy Henry, and I'm here.
Troy, will you pull the microphone? It doesn't have to be right up next to you, but just so it's
sure.
Up your voice. Thank
you. Do you need me to repeat what I was just saying?
Sure.
Okay. So, thank you, Chair Gelser. Thank you, Education Committee, for having me here today. My name is Troy Henry, and I'm presenting testimony as a representative of AFS Intercultural Programs, which has its U.S. Western Regional Headquarters up in Portland, Oregon. That's where I work, and also our National Admission Center there. If you haven't heard of AFS, you might know it as American Field Service, which is what it used to be known as. And it is the oldest and most experienced international high school student exchange organization in the world. So, and Dave, I brought you a copy, too, since I haven't seen that yet. AFS would certainly enthusiastically embrace the legislation that you're considering today. Because as a nonprofit organization, AFS already gives about $1.5 million every year in financial need-based and merit-based scholarships to try to extend opportunities for these wonderfully formative, educational, and life-transforming international exchange experiences. But that is certainly not enough to extend the opportunities to everybody, much less in Oregon. Students who come from families who couldn't afford these programs just by their own resources. And the foresight that the committee can show in supporting being able to extend support from the districts of the state will go a long way in extending those opportunities. It's my particular honor to be speaking in support of this legislation today, not just as a representative of AFS Intercultural Programs, but also as a native Oregonian and a product of our own public school system here. I went to Ashland High School in the Rogue Valley. And as much as I appreciated the nurturing childhood that I had in one of our state's small communities, I also have to be honest in saying that I came into adulthood with a rather insular view of the world. Growing up in the Rogue Valley, for all of its benefits, didn't expose me to a great breadth of different national, linguistic, ethnic, cultural backgrounds. So I sort of have my blinders, and I feel very fortunate to have made the decision early enough in college, where I was still very impressionable, and apparently the language faculties in my brain were still working fairly well. And I was an exchange student in Costa Rica. And so the language that I learned there was Spanish. And it wasn't just about learning about another language or even another culture. But what I found through that experience was that I learned a tremendous amount about myself, about my own culture, and the place where I'm from. And so when I got back from that study abroad experience and returned to my own community in the Rogue Valley, you know, to work for the summer before I went back to school, I was immediately able to apply those linguistic and intercultural communication skills that I developed in Central America. I had two jobs that summer. One of them was working as a seasonal human resources assistant at the largest fruit grower in the Rogue Valley. And the second was I worked in the soccer program at the Boys and Girls Club there locally. For both of those positions, which I'm not sure I would have got if I didn't have Spanish on my resume, I was able to apply that language skill that I developed immediately and every day. And, you know, that was very rewarding. And what it did is it also opened up parts of my community to me that I had been alienated from because I didn't have the skills to engage that part of my community. So, in other words, being an exchange student in Latin America not only made me a better global citizen, but it made me a better Oregonian. And I present my personal experience just as a sincere testament to what can happen when an Oregon public school student has the opportunity to go and study abroad. And while I was very privileged and I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity in college, because a lot of people don't even have that opportunity, I believe that if I'd had the opportunity younger in high school, my learning curve would have been even that much higher, and you know, I would have picked up the language that much quicker, as Representative Parker was sort of alluding to earlier. So, again, the legislation that is being considered by the committee today could be instrumental in extending that opportunity to a greater number of Oregonians. Certainly, my own experience sort of pointed me in the direction that I've taken with my career. And while I was studying for my master's degree in intercultural service leadership and management, I was rather humbled to learn that many of my international colleagues, where I was studying, spoke anywhere from 2 to 5 other languages, aside from the English that was usually not their first language that they were studying for their master's degree in. And that led me to think, how is it that Oregon students of today are going to be able to excel and compete in a global labor market where we have international competition, where people are trilingual, and I don't even know what it would be called if you speak 6 languages, but who speak up to, you know, 6 languages, and have also the experience of crossing international borders and relating to people from very different cultural backgrounds. That's certainly a dynamic in the United States, being a large and largely monolingual society, that we seem to be behind the curve on, and Oregon's no exception to that. It's also a consideration that I think is one that's very important, that Oregon needs to be able to attract international business investment as it continues to develop. If we're going to thrive as a community, we need to have a labor force here to attract the businesses that know that our markets are global, and also know that the skills that are needed in the workplace today include intercultural and multilingual skills to relate to people from different national and cultural backgrounds, even here in the state of Oregon. And I'm going to read this part because I can't keep all the figures straight in my head. While economists predict that most future economic growth will occur in emerging markets in Asia and Latin America, we should consider that Oregon is already economically dependent on overseas trade. In fact, the U.S. Department of Commerce stated that over one-fifth of Oregon manufacturing workers relied on exports for their jobs in 2006, which is the latest year for which figures were available, at least from the research I did. Moreover, just last month in the Oregonian, it was reported that Oregon was the 5th largest agricultural exporter out of any state of the United States. And we sold $2.8 billion of Oregon's agricultural goods abroad in 2008. The same year, Oregon also exported $4.2 billion of computers and other high-value electronic goods. Expanding international education, the opportunities presented in the legislation we're considering today, is a prudent step towards continuing and growing Oregon's place in the global economy. And if economic success and social cohesion here in Oregon, which is becoming an increasingly multicultural and multilingual state, were not strong enough reasons to consider seriously this legislation that's before us today, the last reason that I would offer is peace building. And from my own experience, I get an understanding of what it would mean if more of us in the world, and when I say us, I don't just mean U.S. Americans, but more people around the world had the experience of having lived with another family in another country, being connected with people, sharing bonding experiences that last a lifetime. If everyone had a host mom, host dad, host siblings around the world, I ask what effect that would have on conflict in the world. When we, you know, when there were conflicts and frustration levels were high, and it was suggested that we should attack some place that was no longer just some abstract dot on a map to us. To some of us, we would have personal connections there and understand something about the people who live in those places. What effect would that cumulatively have on the prospect for peace in the future of our world? And I believe, you know, from my professional and personal experience, that that effect would be huge. It's incremental, and it's hard to see as it's happening, but I do feel that this is a very important step so that we can achieve greater international cooperation to face environmental calamity and to stave this sort of downward spiral of war and violence and terror. So I personally, and as a representative of AFS Intercultural Programs, give my wholehearted endorsement to the legislation that you're considering, and I ask that you do consider supporting it. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm open to any questions, of course.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about AFS, Troy. And, when Representative Bailey was talking about the program in Khabarovsk, Portland sister city, one aspect of the program that I don't think he talked about was that part of the program involved counterpart Russian students coming to stay with host families here. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I would argue is a really important part of the program. And actually, I just yesterday heard from our host daughter, Valentina Valia, who is actually a visiting professor at Arkansas State now. She got a law degree, and it's great to be in touch with her. But I wonder if you could talk about that aspect of the AFS experience. Is that normal? Does that happen frequently, that there really are truly exchanges as part of the program?
Yeah. There are a lot of different models out there for international student exchange organizations. AFS is not necessarily a reciprocal and direct exchange program. However, every year, AFS, the other side of what we do, is host exchange students from some 60 countries around the world in the United States, including Oregon, which I think we'd be proud to hear is one of the big hosting states, especially considering our population. So sometimes it is the case that a family, often it'll happen in the other order. First, maybe when a student's young, maybe a freshman in high school or in middle school, a family will host an international exchange student, and that will pique interest in a particular region or a particular country, or maybe just in general in the idea of going and living, you know, immersing yourself in another culture, living with the host family. And so then that student will often go on and be an exchange student later. It's not, I'd say, the norm that the students who go and study abroad through AFS programs necessarily are also of families that host. It's actually often when they, many years later, we've been doing this for 61 years, so we have some good empirics to support this. Often when that student who goes and studies abroad during high school grows up and has her or his own family, then they host students, often from the place that they went to.
Yes, Mr. Porter.
Chair Gellert, could I make two comments?
Of course.
On that? In trying to design the study abroad legislation, if it's a one-way, we're paying, instead of the student to be in the district, we'd be paying to send them abroad. If it's an exchange, we're already paying for the student that comes here, so that it actually ends up costing in total more, because we pay for transportation and other stuff to send them the other way. Not that it isn't a good thing, I'm just pointing it out. And there is I've tried to engage the Rotary in this bill and try to figure out where they fit in. I've had difficulty doing that. The Rotary is a true exchange program. It's not just a student exchange, but it's like between their clubs, they do, you know, it's one student going each way, but it's more than just the families, it's a whole club. They're taking more general responsibility for when they come. And that costs about, as I understand it, about $1,500 for the person to participate in. So under 2719, as I envision it, a school district might have to do 90% of what they got from the state as a minimum to get the state money. That would be in the $5,000 range. That would not pay for AFS programs in total, but it would pay. There are a couple of programs out there that it could pay for, and we would. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit, but there are that the Rotary is particularly an issue. If we were to move ahead, you'd want to decide whether Rotary was eligible as an exchange program for something like 2719 or not eligible. And I've tried to tell them, you tell us what you would like from Rotary, whether you want to be in or out, and they haven't been able to deal with it. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks to both of you for really articulate and well-reasoned presentations on this that raise all of the concerns from expanding peace to threatened military conflict. And if you do not speak the language of the people you are with, you are at a disadvantage in all situations. You can't participate fully in the joyous times of the experience, and you are at a big disadvantage when there are times of conflict and threat. On 2719, I'm a little bit curious about that 90% that you got at.
Is well, the way...
Go ahead.
Taylor Gelser?
Yes, please.
Or is Emma Harker? Let me just back up. If you start with the assumption that for the same amount we're spending, either from the state, I mean, you spend roughly $6,000 of state money for per student going to local district, and they can kick in another $1,000, and they may have federal grants that get it up, or other sources that gets it up a little higher. So there are exchange programs that cost that. In that range, that made me start in that. There are some to Mexico for like $4,800 a year to go down to Mexico and be in a school and live with a family. Yeah, I don't think that includes transportation to and from where they're in Mexico. So for $5,000, we could send students there. You start going other places and other programs, the price go up. Most of AFS programs, I think you start at $8,900 and they go up to, they have some at $9,900 and some at $10,000.
For the year-long program.
We're talking an academic
which
year.
Which, differently than some other programs, do include the international flight and do include the students' insurance. And it's basically everything, you know, all their, of course, expenses while they're there.
Okay, so that's actually the general framework in which you try to design something that... And so it's quite arbitrary what I did to say 90%. You know, that the... you know how the state funding formula works. You get the $4,500, and you know it better than I, I'm sure, and then they kick in some other things, so they weigh some students differently. I'm just saying we want a system. Well, let me see. You could run it directly from the state. You could just say the state's going to pay it, and we'll skip the local school districts. I've tried to put a proposal that puts the discretion in the local school district, that they could control it, but that they would get reimbursed under certain conditions from the state. So that's trying to set, they would need to spend the 90% of what they would get from the state for this in order to count that student for the distribution of state funds. I may not be explaining that very clearly, but
no.
That's actually, I think, one of the issues that legislative council has had a problem understanding from it.
Okay. No, I thought it was clear. I don't know if we want to get down in the weeds on this or not, but I mean, conceptually, I think this is a real nice bill. I haven't gone all the way through it, but I would want to make sure that if we were to pass it, that we wouldn't put something in place that was too restrictive in one way or another. I would want the school, if it were to go, for instance, to the school district, I would want them to be able to retain sufficient funds to cover whatever costs they have associated with such a venture, but not more. I would want as much of the money as possible to go toward this extremely valuable experience. I don't know if we want to think about the implications of it for ESD money, etc.
And I think I would add on to that. I mean, it starts with the assumption that the dollars that come in the ADMW or the ADM through the state school fund track and follow each student precisely. I think also if you run it through the state school fund, you if I hit on something?
No, not at all.
I think the other piece is as you start to look at equity. I mean, when a student is enrolled in a district, all students in the district have to have equal access to whatever it is that's being offered through that program, and then the school district retains responsibility for the costs of, for example, special education services. So in this bill, in the way it was written, there would have to be equal access for students who are talented and gifted and students who have developmental disabilities to also be able to take advantage of the program. So anything that's run through the public school system needs to be available to every child on an equal basis.
Are you asking for a comment?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm not sufficiently knowledgeable of those requirements to speak intelligently to the problem. I don't, certainly talented and gifted, but no, I mean, I would see where the school districts could, if they wanted to, set some language requirements or some grade level requirements. I mean, part of what happens is they need to be able to meet the requirements of the provider program. So there's some screening about some of them. I don't know if AFS does, but some require certain grade point averages to go. They don't want troublemaker students. They don't want this, that, and the other thing. I don't. Well, I, I should have just started.
I think that's the challenge of running something through a public school. One of the challenges, and I think one of the things that makes a public schooling experience so rich, is that we have a responsibility for and we celebrate and accept everyone, from the talented and gifted and the higher grade point averages to students that are troublemakers or have behavior issues or have health issues or have disability issues. So I think, kind of following the line of thinking that I got from Representative Harker, there might be a more appropriate way to try to get at this goal rather than to have a public school district put in a position of not complying with the law in terms of equal access and equal opportunity for all the kids in the public school district.
Chair, I'm not sure I actually see the problem. Maybe you appreciate one that I don't. And are you suggesting it would be better to do it from the state and bypass the...
Does
that get around those problems?
I don't know. I think I'm just... And Representative Maurer's jumping in. I think there's a challenge when you run it through the public school system, because the public school system is just that. It's public school, which is the education of all children. Representative Maurer, were you trying to...
Yeah, Madam Chair, I totally agree, and I think it would be an absolute disaster to say the state is going to commit dollars to these programs, and it's not necessarily even the state law, it's the federal law, because there's a lot of federal dollars that flow through, and I think that you are going into an area that is much better held in a foundation's trust or a private not-profit, private for-profit. But when you use state dollars, when you throw state dollars into the mix, completely changes the argument. And your $8,900 a year, I was looking at the prices in there, double it, triple it, it would cost significantly more for the accommodation piece. At least that's how I see it. But I had a different line, just a little different line. How many exchange students do we have? How many different programs are there in the state of Oregon? We're going to host an Italian student this next fall, this next year, and it's not through AFS, it's through another program. So I honestly don't know how many exchange students there are, how many different programs.
I can't give you a firm answer, Chair, Councilor, Representative Maurer. But at Lincoln, I went to they had a study abroad fair for the high school students, and I would say on the order of 20 programs were there. The national accrediting organization that CSIET, well, they have a fairly long list. I would guess 50, maybe more. Some, but they do both. Some of those specialize just in bringing kids into the country, not sending kids to go abroad. And of course, those are the ones that have asked for accreditation. And we have at least one here in the room that operates out of Portland that does. Sends, I think, both ways.
You go both ways?
Yeah. Goes both ways and is not accredited with CSIET because it doesn't suit their business plan.
Please.
As somebody who's sort of worked in this industry, and this is, you know, when I pursued my master's in and everything, I can say that, yeah, that, I mean, that there's certainly a broad number of providers, and I guess it depends on also how you define a study abroad opportunity or an exchange opportunity, and those can be different things as well. There are some organizations that offer what, frankly, are a little more than teen tours, something that's, you know, short as a spring break or a week, where it's a teacher taking students from their respective class and going to one location and they sort of just stay together. I myself would not consider that, you know, the sort of program that we're talking about. But I can, anyway, bring it back to what AFS has done in terms of sending Oregon students abroad. And over the last, since 2005, in 2005 we sent, through AFS programs, we sent 79 Oregon students abroad. The following year, I believe it was 69. It was 59 in 2007. And, last year we sent 2008, we sent, we're back up to 76. And so far already this year, with the students who went on semester or year programs that started in January or February in the winter, we've already sent 18, and there's a lot of Oregon students who are being interviewed and in the process right now of applying for the programs that depart in the summer and fall.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for this panel before we invite up the next panel? Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, Troy, so in your experience with other states having AFS programs, are there any states in place that that are able to access state dollars, do you know, to support the program?
I know a little bit about that, but I feel like if I were to put something on public record, I would be kind of grossly speculating and probably shouldn't do that. I can't really speak to that off the top of my head.
Thanks.
Chair Gelser, I have asked, somebody else in AFS who I first contacted, and I've asked the executive director of the CSIET if they knew of any school districts that use public money to send students abroad, and in both cases the answer was no. That doesn't mean it isn't out there, but I have not tried to reinvent the wheel. I was thinking if there's a program out there that is doing it, let's find out about it, but I've not been able to find one. So to that extent, if you move ahead, you're doing, I think, something very significant and very innovative, and I think we get recognition for it. I would like to think we could work through the issue of the equal access issue. And
Chair Gelser and committee,
yes.
If I could just add one point. Going back to what we're talking about students with disabilities, and I do know that there is an organization that one of my colleagues from grad school works at in Eugene that is specifically providing study abroad international exchange opportunities for students with physical and mental different abilities. And just on the idea of equity, I certainly understand that everybody is constrained by the legal framework that has, you know, good logic and reason behind it as well. But I guess what strikes me as somebody who maybe is a little bit ignorant of the process and restrictions is just how do we do or promote anything, be it at the district or state level, because even if we fund a football program or, you know, the debate team or whatever it might be, is that really something that is for every single student, regardless of ability levels or whatever else? Or is there some room for, reasonable accommodation, and as Mr. Porter pointed out, to meet the standards of, in this case, the different respective organizations that would be involved?
Thank you. Representative Cobb, thank you for coming and sharing a great testimony. And I think there's another form of equity that beyond the federal regulations and that is financial. There is no way that I could have ever afforded to have one of my daughters participate in something like this. There's absolutely no way. And as a representative of many, many students that live in poverty in my district, this is also completely out of their reach. And yet I do know of school districts, one in particular, that, you know, the community works together with the school district and the football team goes to Hawaii every year to play football. So, to the point, if there's a will, can be a way, but it needs to be equitable in several facets.
So I have a follow-up question for you on that. As I understood this piece, do you think there would have to be an equity element if we did something like this with the state school fund, that any student would be able to take advantage and participate in it and not have to come up with an additional $1,000 or $2,000 in order to participate?
I think that would be the discussion and the debate. And even $1,000 or $2,000 is at least a goal that most families could reach to in several years versus $8,000 or $10,000. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative, Chair, could I just add, there is the accompanying bill that would kick in the $3,000 for the targeted languages. That is both, the intent there is both to target the languages that are needed for the country, but also to give further money to some of those cases that just couldn't come up mm-hmm. with the difference between the amounts.
And Chair Gelser, I'm sorry. I think that in the experience of the organization I work with, typically students are cobbling together funding to cover tuition and other expenses for a program from a number of sources, from scholarships offered from AFS. Over half the students who go on our programs do some sort of personal fundraising. So, mm-hmm. yeah. That wouldn't be, I think, atypical for even outside of this particular consideration to need to bring together funds from multiple angles.
Thank you both very much. So our next panel is Lena Liu and Victoria Yu and Robert Wilner and Craig Fisk. You can pull an extra chair up and we can have a panel of four at one time. So come on up to the table. And I understand that Ms. Liu needs to go soon, so maybe you can start.
Yeah, 3 o'clock. Yeah. Meeting. Yeah. All right, thank you. Okay. Dear Chair and members of the House Education Committee, my name is Lena Liu. I work at Portland State as a professor of Chinese. And currently, I also serve as a chair of Association for Teachers of Chinese in Oregon. And also, I work as a Chinese language program director at the Confucius Institute in Portland State. And today, I come over to the meeting to support expanding Mandarin Chinese program in Oregon. So let me introduce a Confucius Institute a little bit. And it was established in 2007, sponsored by Portland State and the Chinese National Office of Teaching Chinese as Second Language in Beijing. So the mission of the Confucius Institute is to promote educational exchange and the cooperation between U.S. and China. So Confucius Institute provided many activities related to China. For instance, every Friday in Portland State, there is a China Corner and the activities offered about the Chinese culture and the Chinese society. And so last summer, Confucius Institute offered a program for high school students to go to China and to have a summer camp. And besides that, and Confucius Institute offered a Chinese teacher training program last summer. So 3 weeks in Portland State, 3 weeks in 6th University in Suzhou in China. So that's the Confucius Institute. And I also served as a chair for Association of Teachers of Chinese in Oregon. So this organization established in 2002. So the goal is to promote and support teaching and the learning of Chinese in state of Oregon. So by now, so far, we have over 30 members and in Oregon, and we meet twice a year to discuss about teaching issues and problems, and we help and support each other. So far as I know, there is increasing demanding of Chinese language instruction in Oregon, especially in Great Portland area. And so over 50 schools from elementary to university, including weekend schools and evening schools, offer Chinese classes at different levels. So roughly the enrollment is kind of 2,500 students. And still a lot of schools are planning and thinking to offering Chinese classes at their school and at communities. So in Oregon, we have 198 school districts so far, and then PPS, Portland School District, Beaverton School District, Lake Oswego District, Sherwood District, and Tualatin School District, and some district in Eugene offer Chinese classes officially. That means the classes offered during their regular school period. But still other schools, school don't have enough fund to hire a Chinese teacher. So the parents and the school work together to offer Chinese classes at zero period time. So that means before school start, the kids start to learn Chinese class. I mean, in library, in gyms, in the computer lab. In, so I worked as a consultant for West Silver Middle School 2006 and 2007 because PPS doesn't have enough fund to have another Chinese immersion school in west side of Poland, even though they have a flagship in east side of Poland. So the parents and the school and our organization worked together to offer Chinese classes for those students. In 2006, we have only 8 students involved, but 2007, we have 68 students involved. And last year, Silvan Middle School took over. Now it's offer classes for students in regular classes. But and some students could not offer, I mean, afford this taking Chinese class. They don't have opportunity to take the Chinese class. So that's the big issue. Related to this issue is Chinese teacher training. And so far in Oregon, we have 13 Chinese teachers offered by school districts, but none of them have license. They have a temporary license. That means they can work only 2 years, and then they have to renew a license again. It's not only they don't have license, they were not trained. In other words, they don't know how to teach in the classroom. They don't know how to deal with the students. They don't know how, you know, classroom management because they were not trained. So Confucius Institute, in order to solve this problem, Confucius Institute offered a Chinese teacher training in summer 2008, last summer. So there are 25 Chinese teachers participate in the program. Then they took class at 2 weeks in Portland State and 3 weeks in Suzhou University in China. So they are not only learned the theories of teaching Chinese language, but also they learned how to practice, how to do classroom management, to learn the Oregon education law and the school district policies. So it was really successful. And this summer, 2009, and Confucius Institute and Association of Chinese Teachers in Oregon are planning together to offer another second teacher training. We hope, and so far we heard teachers in state of Washington and even in the state of Florida, they didn't have teacher training, so they want to participate. Then we'll have to charge them a little bit more because of out of state. But we do offer our Chinese teachers in Oregon free. The funds come from Chinese government. But also, we really need a state to support this program because eventually Chinese funding will be end very soon. So that's the reason I'm come over to support this expanding Chinese, Mandarin Chinese program in Oregon. Thank you very much. I'm taking any you know, questions.
Thank you. And I think as before, we'll have the whole panel go and then do questions.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Victoria Yu.
And Victoria, can you have the microphone come closer to you? Thank you. We want to be sure to hear what you're saying.
All right, I'm sorry. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Victoria Yu. I am the Executive Director of Asian Education Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. Previous speakers have made a compelling argument on the importance of Mandarin education for the future of Oregon and for America's leadership and competitiveness in the world. Here, I would like to offer some historical perspective that would testify to the merits of their arguments. In 1945, Mao Zedong had firmly established his government in northwest China with 1.2 million Communist Party members and an army of nearly 2 million. The nationalist regime was nearly bankrupt. The Chinese people had built their hopes and dreams on Mao's government. It was only a matter of time before Mao would claim the entirety of China. Mindful of the mammoth tasks of reconstructing a destroyed economy and of erecting a modern nation state, Mao extended his hand to the United States of America for assistance. The U.S. ambassador at that time was Patrick Hurley of Oklahoma. He called Mao Zedong Mouse Tongue by one account, Moose Tongue by another. because not only he was immigrant of China, but apparently had no language talent either. When the communication between the two didn't go anywhere, Mao requested a visit to Washington to talk to Roosevelt directly. But Hardy killed the message. Meanwhile, the American-educated Madame Jiang, the wife of the president of the nationalist regime, who spoke fluent English, charmed the lawmakers in Washington and steered American China policy towards the nationalist favor, in spite of the fact that American officials found themselves dealing with an ineffective administration that was too debilitated to respond to foreign stimuli and had lost the support of the Chinese people. As a consequence of such a China policy, America and the world lost China for nearly three decades. One might argue that the ideological differences would have predetermined the schism between the U.S. and Mao's communist regime in any case. Not necessarily so. Some U.S. officials at the time, such as Secretary of the State Kellogg, was not an ideologue and refused to obsess by the menace of communism. And Mao harbored lifelong admiration towards the U.S. When his comrades were studying Russian, Mao studied English. We can only imagine that what a history-altering difference it would have made had the U.S. ambassadors at that time been even somewhat knowledgeable of Mandarin and Chinese history, and therefore able to have meaningful communications with Mao. This historical reference underscores the importance of mastering a foreign language, Mandarin in particular, within a profound geopolitical context. Unfortunately, the knowledge of China among decision makers in this country today is still far from sufficient. Let's not send Patrick Hurley to China again. So that is why we support this bill. Now we know, we also understand that no education program without apparent economic underpinnings will be appealing to many, particularly at a time of tremendous economic distress. Therefore, we believe that it makes sense for the state to develop an Asia strategy as an integral component of Oregon Economic Development Plan. Mandarin education in the framework of a concrete Asian strategy would have more evident practical applications that appeal to a broader base of support. Presently, the Chinese government has offered financial incentives to encourage businesses to establish joint overseas R&D centers. The global financial meltdown has created an opportunity for China to make investment abroad. We should work with the private sectors to identify potential collaboration projects and attract Chinese investment to Oregon. We must have the political will and the determination to act quickly and decisively in order to take advantage of this opportunity. When commenting on Gary Locke's appointments as the Commerce Secretary, a prominent businessman of Seattle said, "We get up every morning looking west," meaning Asia, "where we see our growth will be. Located in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon should also adopt an Asian orientation in developing its economic development strategy. We would like to propose the establishment of a task force under the leadership of the legislature or the governor's office, working in partnership with the Oregon Business Council to develop a short-term and long-term Asian strategy. And Asian Education Foundation would enthusiastically support and offer participation in this undertaking."
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, whichever of you chooses to go next is fine with us.
Andrew Forbury. approval because of my name. I'm Bob Wilner. You've already heard from me earlier this week.
Yes.
So I won't go into details except to say that one of the outcomes of this Oregon International Council that I represent is the little blue booklet you just received, which we've been publishing for the last 20 years as a directory of international education opportunities in the state of Oregon. We don't claim it's complete, but we think it's a pretty decent indication of the variety that is available, and I think that it is encouraging that it's been going for this long and people still seem to be interested in it. I would endorse strongly the current legislative proposal in just the concept of anything that enhances our international awareness in this country and in this state as being a very important step in preparing for the future. But I have to point out there's some obstacles. One of them is in the ethics law that was passed by the 2007 legislature. One of the many unintended consequences of that law is a provision that has been interpreted by the State Ethics Commission as this prohibition on public officials receiving gifts means that teachers accompanying students overseas may not receive any payment for their travel unless the program is fully endorsed by the teacher's district, which is a rather prohibitory requirement because it creates all sorts of liability issues for the district. And the result has been that some of these programs have declined in participation. Now, these are not programs of the dimension that's been discussed here, but these are egg breakers that get.
And we've got a bill on that one that we've already heard. So we had a whole day talking about that challenge.
That particular challenge.
That particular challenge.
I'm so
challenge,
glad it's been discussed
because
I think it's a very important one, and it's been the source of a lot of problems. I will say that I think some educators may have abused their position to do a few things like this, but the benefits, vastly outweigh the disadvantages. So I guess I'll leave it at that. I'm delighted to know that there's some steps being taken in that direction, and I won't bother you with any more details, and I thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, and thank you for coming back.
I'll take two microphones. My name is Craig Fisk, and I'm here representing Chair Gelser and members of the committee. I'm here representing the Northwest China Council and in support of all of these bills relating to increasing the amount of focus on Chinese language teaching in the schools. And really the one statement in the testimony that we wanted to submit that we consider to be key is that the three largest economies in the world now are the United States, Japan, and China, and we think that our language teaching and educational priorities ought to be aligned with that fact. It's a very simple matter of realigning and supporting where our priorities go. I wanted to say a little bit about the Northwest China Council additionally as a resource here, and I can give a little bit of background on myself. The Northwest China Council is a 501c3 nonprofit in Portland. It was started in 1980, and it does monthly and periodic programs on Chinese business connections, Chinese culture, and also teaches language for adult students. In the past year, we taught on the order of 1,500 classroom hours, presented monthly lectures on Chinese-U.S. business relationships, and also presented cultural events that involved a significant number of professional people in the Portland area. In the Oregon economy, my background is Intel and then software company that I started, raised several rounds of venture capital for, and I'm currently engaged in social networking software development. I'm also on the board of Legion of Tech in Portland, which puts on a number of technology-related events in addition to the Northwest China Council. And so I guess my focus is on seeing that some of the large companies in Oregon, ranging from Intel, which has a large production facility that's going up in Dalian in northeast China, to development centers in Beijing and Shanghai for software and other technology. Nike, Columbia Sportswear, Columbia Forest Products, there are a number of significant companies that have a very strong connection there. But unfortunately, probably most of the language talent that is being engaged is coming from somewhere outside of Oregon. And so we need to strengthen our capabilities there. My own background is I also did a PhD in comparative literature, originally studied Chinese at the university level, and then taught in Taiwan for a couple of years, ended up as a department chair, and actually initiated a fairly radical transformation of the language teaching program at the time toward much more business and foreign communication use. So I'm very sympathetic to the idea of modifying curriculum in that direction. We basically went from memorizing Shakespeare to being able to negotiate foreign deals, and it was quite a transformation that the students were very motivated by. I also was a Fulbright Fellow in Germany. I had to pass the German language exams to get into the university programs there, and I was hosted as a Fulbright Fellow by a German family that had a background of, wife, my would-be host mother, had been a translator for the German army in Baghdad, Arabic and German, during the Second World War. She and her husband had both worked for NATO after the war in Paris. And as Representative Bailey mentioned, and also as Troy Henry mentioned, for many of our peers elsewhere in the world, knowing three or four languages is quite a natural part of their environment. So we need to be encouraging that here. And my children also have grown up very much in an international context. My son studied Japanese, worked for the mayor of Hiroshima for several years, and then for a law firm in Tokyo, and is now in law school in Berkeley. And so I had to work on my Japanese a couple of years ago to be able to communicate with my grandson better. And my daughter studied French and Arabic and Wolof and was an exchange student in Africa. I think that the combination of elements that are in the various bills that are being considered, I heartily support all of them. The idea of immersion in the different districts, the idea of equity and maintaining the access for students no matter what their economic background, and also the idea of foreign exchange. I think foreign exchange is extremely important as part of this program, and I think that we recognize that there certainly is an interest on the Chinese side in bringing people here as well. So I take any questions that you like.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd actually just like to make a comment. Something that we haven't really touched on at all is the high number of immigrants that we have coming to Oregon from all over the world. And I believe that people who have had experience in language, and certainly with experience living abroad, studying abroad, tend to be more understanding and welcoming of people who come to this country and going through the culture shock of living in a new country and having to deal with a second language, and often being treated as children or less than intelligent people just simply because they're not fluent in English and are just going through that shock of culture. And I think that really is a very important indirect sort of benefit of these experience abroad programs, because, going back to what Representative Comp said, a lot of our students are coming from families that are quite disadvantaged, and on their own they're not going to have that foreign travel experience just because their own family means don't make that possible. And so, the more that we can encourage programs which will, give them that opportunity, I think the richer we'll be as a state.
Thank you, Representative Comp.
My comment is similar to what Representative Dimbro is discussing, because what I am absolutely saddened that there's only 13 Chinese teachers in Oregon. And so along with that, that shocking statement is, well, what's wrong with this? How come we're not moving forward? I can't tell you how many years we've talked about that everybody should have the opportunity to learn two languages. And when I became a middle school principal, we had the discussion, well, we can't do this. We can't teach two languages. We can't do this. We can't get our math scores up. We can't get our students to write complete sentences. I would challenge us as a body, not just as this committee, unless we set a goal and a vision. When I started, we only had not even 10% of our staff spoke two languages. In 6 years, we were up to 50% of our staff teaching two languages. And that's because that was part of our vision, that if we want our students to be able to be fluent in two languages, then we needed to have our staff also. And so was that easy to teach? Get people have the certification and all those pieces that you have that you discussed. No, but you can do it if you work as a community to do it. And so I, because we need to somehow, we need to get serious about this subject.
All right, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sold. It really makes sense, and I don't know what we'll be able to do, but I mean, speaking personally, I'm sitting here and my mind's wandering to my many grandkids, and I'm motivated. The very least I'm going to do is go out and make sure that my grandkids are, you know, swept up in what I think is a very necessary future.
Thank you. Any further comments? Thank you all very much for coming today, sharing your thoughts and ideas. I think certainly this is an area that the state needs to make great progress in. Mm-hmm. I think what's been referenced here often is the struggle between having a necessary aspirational goal and a measurable plan for getting there, and setting those in the midst of a budgetary crisis for public schools. And I'm thinking back to the testimony of Mr. Porter and the reference to the percentage of the school budget, and it used $6 billion as a K-12, you know, budget for a biennium. And, you know, we're in a place where we're probably looking at something closer to $5.5 billion as opposed to $6 billion. So we certainly are in a time where districts are going to be struggling, but we can't set this aside. We need to figure out how we can move forward in the face of that struggle. Representative Comp.
But what I would say on the record, it doesn't cost you any more to have a second language teacher than it does a first language teacher.
Okay, Representative Comp, absolutely. And I would also say on the record that, you know, some of what we heard in terms of where does what we're teaching as a second language match with where the global economy is going, I think one can certainly ask the question, why do we have so many schools that are teaching Italian and German and French and so few that are teaching Chinese and Japanese? And and that's a shift in culture as well. Yes.
May I intercede here? I testified before this committee some years ago and helped to get in the SIM law a second language study requirement for all students. It lasted in the law 3 or 4 years until it threatened to go into effect, and then it was eliminated.
Okay.
And I would just say that is the battle we have to think about for the future.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other reference that Mr. Porter made, I believe, was to the accomplishments of the Lincoln administration in a time far worse than what we experience. We have very serious challenges before us, but nothing compared to what was going on then, and the accomplishment of visionary introduction of policy and alteration of the direction of the nation were able to take place then. We can do something along the lines of what we're talking about here.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. And I will close the public hearing on House Bills 2605, 2606, 2607, and 2719. I will see you again next Wednesday. Remember, Monday is an in-district day, so we will not be meeting here. Have a great weekend, and the House Committee on Education is adjourned.
Thank you.